Now we're entering the second and the middle unit. I mean, the middle chapter of the unit. There's three chapters. This last one that we just finished was an introductory chapter about metabolism in general. Now for these final two chapters, we're going to study specific processes, specific pathways or groups of pathways. And the third one, the third chapter, which we haven't started yet, will be about photosynthesis. This chapter is about, well, the overall chapter is about a set of processes that collectively I'm calling the complete oxidation of glucose. Now, this figure shows the phrase cellular respiration, and that's actually what the chapter in the book is called, the book that I got this out of. But cellular respiration is not the entire process. Cellular respiration is just part of the overall process that is called the complete oxidation of glucose. Okay, so we are going to study cellular respiration in this chapter, but also more stuff. This opening slide, I want to talk a little bit about because not only is it important in its own right, but because it sets up these two remaining chapters, shows you their relationship with each other. These two major processes, photosynthesis and the complete oxidation of glucose, have a reciprocal relationship. What I mean by a reciprocal relationship is that one of the processes undoes what the other process does. So in a sense, they are inverses of each other or opposites of each other. But importantly, since these are pathways we're talking about, it's not simply that the same pathway is run in one direction or the other. That's not what happens. It seems like that in what we call the summary reactions, but it's not really how it happens. Now, speaking of summary reactions, we're talking about pathways here, which we've already talked about is multiple reactions, not a single reaction, right? But a pathway, however long it is, has a beginning and an end. And even though a pathway doesn't turn that initial thing into that final thing in one step, you can pretend that it happens in one step, like one reaction. And you can, in other words, summarize the entire pathway just by writing one reaction shown in one step, even though that's not what happens. Okay, so there's a summary reaction for photosynthesis, and there's a summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose. And those are reverses of each other. That's the reciprocal relationship between these two processes. We can see that in the slide, even though they use the phrase cellular respiration, rather it should be complete oxidation of glucose. The box with the greenish background, as you see, represents an ecosystem. And I actually mentioned this before when we were talking about the biological hierarchy. When we talked about ecosystems originally, I said that, or I think I said this, maybe I didn't, but what's true of any given ecosystem is that there is a throughput of energy. Energy flows through an ecosystem, in other words. Comes in, goes out. Now, what goes out is not the same kind of energy because the energy that comes in gets transformed and transferred from thing to thing within the ecosystem. But then energy leaves as well. Comes in as light, as you see, gets transferred and transformed, but then leaves as heat. Materials, on the other hand, as opposed to energy, get recycled within the ecosystem. So you can see this happening with carbon dioxide and water, organic molecules and oxygen. Okay, now this reciprocal relationship that I'm talking about is represented by this cycle. Even though photosynthesis is the focus of next chapter, I want to tell you what it does in general so that we can understand this reciprocal relationship. Photosynthesis happens in only certain kinds of organisms. What kind of organisms am I talking about?
Plants and algae and producers, right?
Producers, exactly. Producers, only producers can undergo photosynthesis. We can't. We are consumers, examples of consumers, right? Now, there are producers that do the same thing as photosynthesis, but using a different source of energy other than light. Those are called chemosynthetic organisms. But synthetic organisms, the synthetic refers to building things, only producers can synthesize organic molecules out of inorganic carbon sources. So I need you to think back to our discussion of what makes something organic to begin with. Remember that the chemical definition of organic is not simply contains carbon. That doesn't go far enough. Because pure carbon, like graphite in your pencil or the diamonds that you have in your safe, are not organic, right? So it's not enough to say containing carbon. And there are also even some carbon-containing compounds, carbon with other atoms, that aren't considered organic. And the most important one in this course is carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide is an inorganic molecule. But obviously it contains carbon. All organisms absolutely require organic molecules. That's what they're made out of, right? The whole chapter that we surveyed, the organic macromolecules, those are the big ones. There are small organic molecules that are required as well, but you can't do a very good job of living without proteins, nucleic acids, lipids, or polysaccharides, right? And those are all organic molecules. So you can't have an organism without organic molecules. But only the producers of the world are able to assemble organic molecules starting with a carbon source that is inorganic. And that is the real important thing that photosynthesis accomplishes. We give that a special name, which is called carbon fixation. To fix carbon, chemically speaking, means to take carbon from an inorganic source, CO2 in this case, and incorporate that carbon into organic molecules, which is going to have carbon-hydrogen bonds and other things in there as well. Now, we consumers of the world need organic compounds just like any organism does. But we can't make organic compounds out of inorganic carbon sources. So even though we can make our own organic compounds by rearranging things, we have to start with organic compounds to do that rearrangement. In other words, the carbon that we use for our organic compounds has to come from molecules that are already organic. That's what you eat. No matter what you eat, animal, plant, fungus, you're eating some organism that's made out of organic material. That's what consumers do because they can't make their own. But plants and other photosynthetic organisms are able to use CO2 as the carbon source and make organic compounds. That's what I'm calling carbon fixation. So the inputs into photosynthesis as an overall process are CO2 and water. All right? Now, the steps aren't shown. We'll talk about the steps in its own chapter. But so it's not just a one-step process. But after many steps, what comes out of photosynthesis is organic molecules, specifically sugars. Once it's in organic form, not only can the plant then use those sugars as fuel, which is an important use of sugars, but now that you already have organic molecules in the form of sugar, you can use them and rearrange them into other organic compounds, like amino acids to make proteins and so on. All right, so organic molecules can be used as fuel or raw materials. That's one output. And oxygen is another output. What I keep calling the reciprocal relationship between these two processes is that the outputs of one process are the inputs into the other, and the inputs into one process are the outputs of the other. Okay, so now we have output organic molecules, and chief among those is glucose, because it's the most important fuel in cells. Glucose and oxygen come out. Well, notice that those are exactly the two things that go into the reciprocal process, which is the complete oxidation of glucose. And in terms of the summary reaction, it's the reverse of photosynthesis. Glucose and oxygen are inputs, and over many steps that we'll look at the details of in this chapter, the outputs are carbon dioxide and water. So the organic molecule that we're talking about for this bottom process, the complete oxidation of glucose, that's used as a fuel. Fuels are sources of energy that are released for the purpose, or the energy is released by burning those fuels, oxidizing those fuels, for the purpose of building ATP, which is now storing energy that was in the fuel. This is what we've just been talking about in the previous chapter. That's why ATP is shown here on this slide. All right? That's the goal of the complete oxidation of glucose, to build as much ATP as possible so that you can then power as much endergonic processes as possible. But in the course of doing that, what you do with that fuel, which is a carbon skeleton with hydrogens on it and other things, is if you use it completely, and that's why I call it the complete oxidation of glucose, you totally dismantle that organic compound. You dismantle the carbon skeleton, and you take off all the hydrogens that are stuck onto it. That's what gives you the energy. So if you do that with glucose, which is six carbons, you break that six carbon piece into six one-carbon pieces, each of which has no hydrogens left. That's why the result is carbon dioxide. And I don't know whether you've thought about your own carbon dioxide or not throughout your life. I mean, I'm sure you know that you need to take in oxygen and you need to get rid of CO2. You breathe that out. But did you think about where these come from? The carbon dioxide that you exhale each breath is what's left over from the food that you ate. Those bigger molecules of food that are too big to get into your body first need to be digested while they're in your digestive tract, which is still outside your body, like I said. You get those into small enough pieces to bring into your cells, and then you use primarily glucose that's coming in from those food as fuel inside the cells. You do this in this bottom process, and that totally dismantles those simple sugars, those glucoses, until what's left is CO2. CO2 is completely spent fuel. It's no longer has any energetic use for a cell, and that's why you get rid of it. But by breaking it down completely, because you can also just go part of the way and not completely dismantle it. If you do it the whole way, though, you get a maximum amount of ATP. And that's this bottom process. Well, the CO2, and you also make water in the process, which are the two things that directly feed back into photosynthesis for another round. So this reciprocal relationship can be viewed as happening between a producer and a consumer, which is true, but a plant, as a typical producer, is not trying to feed us, right? The reason the plant is undergoing photosynthesis is to make organic molecules for its own use, as its own fuel. It's feeding itself. And I don't want you to lose track of the fact that, if we think back to the tour of the cell chapter, that a plant cell has chloroplasts, which is where photosynthesis takes place, but it also has mitochondria, like our own cells. So the reciprocal relationship also occurs within the plant, within the producer. It undergoes the top reaction set so that it can feed the bottom set. So it's doing both of these things. We're just doing one of them. Now, why does heat come out at the bottom? Second law of thermodynamics. Now, there's many, many steps involved in each of these things. And every step along the way is going to be at least partially wasteful, because you can never get as much energy put to work as is available originally. And therefore, heat is produced. Now, that's not to say that that heat is not valuable other ways, by the way. For instance, we are examples of what are called endothermic homeotherms. The word homeotherm means that we keep our temperature steady. But endothermic homeotherms refers to the fact that the source of the heat that keeps our body temperature steady, even when it's cold out, is our own metabolism. So the wastefulness of that metabolism doesn't produce the work, but it does. The heat is actually valuable. It keeps us warm. All right, now I have, 10 minutes left? So let me go on to slide 2 and study this reaction. This is what kind of reaction, if you use one word?
Biotic?
Well, yes, it is. That's correct. But what I was looking for was redox. This is a redox reaction. Remember that portmanteau? Redox, combination of two words, reduction and oxidation. And when I first defined that in lab weeks ago, I said that we're eventually going to be talking a lot more about redox reactions for this chapter and the next, but especially this chapter. And I want you to remember that if you have redox, it's good to use the one word for both, because if something is being reduced, something else has to be oxidized. So you have either neither happening or you have both, not just one or the other. So remember what reduction is, or remind me. Prove that you remember what reduction is. What is reduction, chemically speaking? Remember, I said that this is linguistically counterintuitive, because when we think of the everyday use of the
word, reducing its energy, so it's losing. It's gaining an electron.
That's why it's confusing. Yes. That's right. Reduction is the gain of an electron, which seems not to make sense linguistically, but remember that an electron is carrying a negative charge. So by receiving it, your charge is going down. That's what's being reduced, in a sense. But however you remember it, remember that reduction is gain of electron. The opposite of that is oxidation, which is loss of an electron. And this is why you have to have both happening if you're going to have either happen, right? Because an electron doesn't pop into existence or pop out of existence. It's there the whole time. And therefore, if something gains it, something else has to lose it. Well, we can see that redox clearly is happening in the chemical reaction that we started with. When we first talked about chemical reactions, we talked about sodium and chlorine, right? This is that same reaction. And you're correct in saying that this is an ionization, because each of these two reactants becomes ionized. But one of them is a metal, sodium, and one of them is a nonmetal, chlorine. And remember that metals and nonmetals form ions different ways. Metals form ions by losing electrons. Nonmetals form ions by receiving electrons. So specifically, the sodium in this reaction is becoming oxidized because it's losing its electron to become Na+. The chlorine is receiving the electron, and therefore it's becoming reduced into Cl-. Alright, now clearly ionization must be redox because there's a transfer of electrons. So something is giving it up, something is receiving it. By definition, that's redox. We'll see though that it doesn't necessarily have to be ionization for it to qualify as redox. Slide three is really the same thing. It's just not showing you a specific example. This is a generic symbolization. So X and Y are not elements, right? They're not on the periodic table. They just represent two different elements. XE minus, the E minus is the electron. So at the moment, XE minus has the electron. Y doesn't. Y, X gives it up, and Y takes it on. So it's the same thing, but just in a generic case. Once again, though, the thing that becomes reduced is the thing that receives the electron. Do you remember what oxidizing agent means? The oxidizing agent is the thing becoming reduced. Yes, it's called the oxidizing agent because it oxidizes something else in order to become reduced. So what is the oxidizing agent here? Y, correct. And what is X considered? The reducing agent, which is called that because it is causing something else to be oxidized. Okay. I don't want to start this with only a couple minutes left, so let's stop at 4.